Hello, this podcast is recorded on Gadigal country and we pay our respects to the First Nations custodians of the land, both here and also wherever you're listening from.
Lee Sales.
Annabelle Crabb.
Now, I know it's been a little while since Easter.
Yes.
But I've recently learned, i.e. seriously seconds ago, that you have never seen the film Jesus Christ Superstar.
No, but I've listened to the soundtrack many a time.
Right, okay.
Every time I look at you, I don't understand. Just throwing that out there.
Okay, I believe you. So why would you never have seen the film, which is just a piece of epic genius?
Is it really?
Yeah.
Is this an old film?
Yeah. It's like 1974, I think.
Oh.
Yep, it's about the same age as me.
Who's in it?
Well, so the backstory is, you know, Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote the concept album.
Yeah.
And then, and I think it was put on in the UK but didn't really sort of spread anywhere.
Right.
And then an actor called, I've got this written down, Barry Dennen, who plays Pontius Pilate in the film, was earlier making Fiddler on the Roof, in which he played a minor role with the director Norman Jewison, and slipped him a copy of the concept album.
Mm.
And Norman Jewison listened to it and became inflamed by it and decided to make this film.
Oh.
And so the film is, it features, well, the three main roles, Jesus, Judas and Mary Magdalene, are played by the same actors who won Tonys for it on stage. And it was sort of like first time film appearance for most of the people in the film. And it's set in the Israel desert and it is a 1970s explosion of adaptation of Christ's life story, right? So it starts off and it's just desert haze and then you see this sort of jeep that turns out to be a bus and it's the cast arriving and they just pull all their shit off the bus and then they go into the opening number. Like it's kind of like it's not a play within a play type thing, but it's just,
Wow.
Yeah. And they're all wearing like flares and, you know, kind of waistcoats and, but like it is nuts.
So how did you come to be watching this?
Because I've watched it every Easter since I was about six. Like, no, that's not true. I've watched, actually, I know what the answer to this is, for 30 years, which is the length of time that I've been in a relationship with Jeremy Storer.
Oh, because he likes it.
He knows every single word to every single song.
Yeah, he likes
it. So it's an Easter, like children get made to watch it. And, I mean, it's fantastic.
Does it ever alarm you that basically...
No, I know what you're about to say.
You've chosen a life partner and then you've aligned yourself with someone as a professional partner, i.e. me, and we're basically the same person.
It is... It's the only way I remember to turn up to things because basically.
I'm just so relieved that Jeremy has to handle the sex end of the equation. That's all I'm going to say.
Look,
Jeremy, for taking one for the team.
But yeah, and sometimes when I see you guys get all excited about talking dates and like, when are we going to, and then, oh, and what time are we going to arrive and where are we going to stay? And that is like, it's like actually sandpaper on my brain. Any sentence that starts with, when are we, or how many, or have you done the blah, blah, blah? I'm like,
ugh. Also, you often will say something to me that Jeremy said, and I'll be thinking, yeah, well, exactly.
But I'll be complaining about it? Yeah. Anyway, one thing that we do definitely have in common is this film. And I'm going to make sure that sometime soon I sit you down and I make you watch it because it's mind-blowing.
I'm going to go along with this because the last thing you did this to me for was Cabaret.
Yeah.
And it was, and I was just like, well, this was the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to roll with that.
Yeah.
You raising this makes me feel particularly shallow because watching masterpieces of 70s cinema, I've been continuing my Ryan Reynolds deep dive.
Jesus Christ. I mean, superstar. What? How?
Okay.
How is there anything left in that man's herb?
Previously on Chat 10, after loving and watching Deadpool, Murph recommended to me to watch, what was that film called? Not The Fall Guy, but it's Fall, It was the one where Ryan Reynolds is in a computer game. I forget what it is, but and I didn't like
it. I've seen it and I can't remember what it's
called. And I didn't like it. So after these Welcome to Wrexham and these things that were making me love Ryan Reynolds, I've seen this other thing and I'm, ew. Anyway, a lot of chatters had jumped on and said, you need to watch The Proposal, which I had never seen. See previous points about never having seen anything Ryan Reynolds has done. Uh-huh. So I've whacked that film on, which is the one with Sandra Bullock, who the premise is she's his boss and basically she's about to be deported to Canada because she's a Canadian citizen. She needs to get married and Ryan Ross is her kind of PA and she says, well, we have to get married so that you can help me avoid being deported.
Hilarity ensues.
Oh, it was absolutely charming. I loved it. It was just a delightful romantic comedy. You've got Nana voice on now. Oh, it was a delightful romantic comedy. Oh, he was a lovely young man. It was absolutely charming. So, yeah.
So
I'm back on the Ryan Reynolds track.
Okay.
I'm back on the Ryan Reynolds train, which is lucky because the new season of Welcome to Wrexham is dropping on May the 3rd.
So the other day when we were having some sort of WhatsApp conversation with a number of people about your Ryan Reynolds issues. You knew how many followers he had on Instagram or something. And somebody said, I can't believe you know his stats. And you said something like, mate, I know his shoe size. I was just like, oh, sounds healthy.
Now, I won't have you looking down at me for my Ryan Reynolds deep dive because I happen to know that you've been immersing in some serious trash.
I've been like, I've done worse things than you in the last couple of weeks. I have dug deeper and I've gone filthier than you ever have.
Lay it on me,
do you know
babe.
Why? Because I have watched MILF Manor.
Boing. Boing, 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 boing. What the actual?
So, do you remember that episode way back when of 30 Rock where in the writer's room, you know how they've always got these disgusting ideas that they can't ever put on television and Liz Lemon's like, ugh, you guys. One of them has an idea for a TV show called MILF Island, which is just populated by hot middle-aged women and like young men of their children's age.
Oh my God. Right? And someone's actually made this show. Oh. God.
So now my teenage daughter made me watch this the other day. And now let me just say, I mean, I learn a lot from my teenage daughter and normally it's sort of, I mean, I learn a lot about bands that I haven't heard of and, you know, obscure poets that write in the second person. So, you know, like, but she said she was feeling a bit sad. She's like, I just want to watch something terrible and I've got an idea of what something we should watch together. I'm like, what's that? She goes, MILF Manor. And I'm like, what? Anyway, so let me tell you the premise.
Oh.
It is like, it is unbelievable television. So it's all set in this resort in Mexico and the opening scene is this woman with bone structure that cannot be older than about 10, but she is in her 50s, sort of sashays onto set, and she has applied to be part of this reality dating show, intergenerational dating. She's into younger men, has always been into younger men, and she's, you know, was married for X amount of years, blah, 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 blah. And then she's like, ooh, where are these young men? And then what they do is they bring in successively more women until the end there's like about 10 of them that have all met each other and, you know, they're kind of sizing each other up because they know that they're there to do like some sort of dating show with younger men. So who's got the greatest ass and who's got like, you know, who's the most outgoing? Who's
so there's
got
none
the tits
that look like us.
There is no one who looks like us. There's no one who even looks like us on a super good day.
Well, that's a big loss for that young man.
It really is. Yeah, it is. Anyway, so they're all chatting and then they're like, okay, ladies, you know that you're here to meet some younger guys and we've got them here and they've got these guys all lined up behind a sort of rice paper screen and they've got these chicks who are like, that all of them by this stage are about 30% Pinot Gris. So
right.
They're kind of like, woo!
Right.
And then rice. Sorry. So the screen rolls. Sorry, I've got to speak using my diaphragm. I'm, you know. So the screen rolls back and it's there's an equal number of young men to the number of women. And every single one of the young men is the son of one of them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So they're all like, hey, baby, woo. And then they're like, fuck, Josh.
Oh, my God.
And so the conceit is, I mean, brilliant casting ploy.
Wow.
I mean, you've got to respect it.
The shock value because, of that reveal must be just.
And I mean, look, I don't know. How can they, I mean, well, really? But apparently, look, the sort of cover story, which is a bit gossamer thin for mine because, I mean, come on, is that they recruited the mums and the sons kind of on separate premises and said to the sons, oh, you're coming to Mexico to film a different set. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like, whatever. Oh. Who cares? Don't, you know.
Right.
Don't ruin the magic, Annabelle. It's a pretty weird premise, though.
Does anyone withdraw at that point or they just press on?
Mate, on MILF Manor, no one withdraws.
Well, they are young men.
The withdrawal method is past its use by date. So there's this one kind of like one lady who's so up for it. I can't remember her name, but she's got like some very impressive boobs that are getting a real walk out. And and she's got a crush immediately on the son of this woman that she's talking to who's like, you are not going. That's clearly where we're going. But so the next twist is that of the rooms available in MILF Manor, there are a couple of rooms that are sort of seriously sex pad type rooms that have got jacuzzis and like, you know, back staircases and like all the dirty accoutrement that you would want for a reality show where you are not only on the same show as your son, but you're also sharing a room with your son.
Yeah.
They've like all of the rooms have got two double beds in the room and mum sleeps in one and son sleeps in the other. So in order to like get your rocket polished by mum, you've got to make a deal with her son.
Could you imagine one of your friends hooking up with your son? I mean, your son's young, but let's put him 10 years forward.
Wow,
it would be...
So the first
absolute friendship breaker
is they're all competing to get one of these good rooms. And so the first challenge is they line up all the men. They're all topless and they're all wearing an identical necklace. And the women are blindfolded and they have to work their way along the line and they're only allowed to touch shoulders, arms, chests. And they've got to identify their own child.
Oh, this is just sickening. Oh.
And
God. So how much of this show did you watch?
Well, I love a freak, you know, as you know. I like watching people do things that I would never do. So I found it really interesting on that level.
Is it American or British?
It's American.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, it's American. Can you imagine what like MILF Manor, the British version would be like?
Rough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd just have that UKIP guy and like, you know. Speaking of which, I know that, and I'll round off MILF Manor in a minute, but I know you've been listening to that, I think, genius new podcast by Marina Hyde and your buddy who writes the detective,
Richard Osman,
that called The Rest is Entertainment. God, I learned so much from that show because they both are really knowledgeable about formats. They watch things that I haven't watched. And the way that they talk about, because they are completely small C Catholic in their tastes and they watch a lot of reality and they talk about it in a way that's so informed. The most recent episode I listened to was about the Oscars and Ozempic and like the role that Ozempic played at the Oscars. Anyway, they're both such gossip sluts, but also
have they talked about MILF Manor on that pod?
No, but that's what I want. So Marina, please, MILF Manor.
Or
I don't think so. Anyway, maybe they haven't. I've missed it, but anyway, I'm loving that podcast. Whoop! Back to Slutsville. So I sort of was watching this just with my eyes out in stalks, and then I sort of started to drift off to sleep. And as I was drifting off to sleep, like, my eyelids closed, but I could still hear what was happening. And when I drifted off, I thought, because the second challenge was that they all had to write a filthy secret about themselves, like mums and sons, and like stick them on post-it notes on a board. And all the mums and sons, like all of them together, not this is the lady secrets, this is the boy secrets. And so they had to pick which one was written by their mum or their son. Oh. And it was like, there was one that's like, I grinded a granny at a party and I loved it. But then like, and there was one like, I was in a seven woman orgy, an orgy with seven women or something. And that turned out to be one of the mums. Like it's just, it was like, ooh. Anyway.
Oh, man. Okay. That sounds pretty full on. I've been watching something with my kids.
Are you proud of me? Like, because
I am proud of you, actually.
Filth.
I'm proud of you.
You are filth.
I'm proud of you for just dipping a toe in the filthy waters of Milfsville or whatever it was called, Milf Manor.
Milf Manor.
I wouldn't be proud of you if you went on the show. I'm just making that clear. But I'm proud of you for giving
just
it a
stab. Waiting the right offer.
The opening of this pod's not gone where I thought. Between Jesus Christ Superstar and Milf Manor, that's not what I thought you were going to bring to the table. I've been watching something with my kids as well, which is a bit more wholesome than that, which I was very late to the party on, and which our friend Gwen told me, I'm going to say, several years ago to watch, and I finally got around to it, and Gwen, of course, was like, oh, God, why don't you listen to me? Derry Girls.
Yeah, I've watched the whole thing.
It's magic. Absolutely magic. I've got about three episodes to go and I just feel like, oh, I can't bear to not have any more of these people in my life.
Sweetie.
I love them so much. It's so funny, but it's also really touching. It's just bloody wonderful.
It actually makes you almost just sob with laughter sometimes.
Oh, there's some things. There's a character called Uncle Colm who is, everyone's met someone like this, who is a person who just does not know how to tell an anecdote, and they just go on and on and on and on, and there's never a point, but it never ends and so forth. And there's an episode where they've been busted breaking into the school and they carted off to the police station. This is this group of schoolgirls, the Derry Girls, and Liam Neeson is playing the police officer, and they're trying to work out how to get out of it. And one of them has the brain stroke of, get Uncle Colm down here. And so he starts as the responsible adult. And so Uncle Colm starts telling one of his church stories. And Liam Neeson is so funny in, like, just get them out of here, shut him up, get him away from me, and get them out of here. It's just, it is the funniest, most delightful show. I'm absolutely loving it.
I remember in the first series, because, like, it's set at this girls' school, and these girls are just like fantastic junior slappers, and like
yeah, they're great.
And it's in Northern Ireland, so they're kind of, you know, going through, you know, checkpoints to get to
Northern
school
Ireland
and
in
stuff.
The 1990s.
Yeah, and there's this, they go to this girls' school, but there's this one boy who goes there as well.
It's the cousin,
and
James.
Yeah, and they're just like, oh, don't worry about him, he's gay. And he's like, I'm not, I'm just English.
There's constant paying out on him for being English. There's a beautiful scene, actually, where he decides, he's the cousin of one of the girls and he's been sent up to Ireland because mum's not a very good mother. And the mother comes for a certain point at a visit, having not seen him for several years, and he decides he's going to go back to England with the mum. And everyone knows this is a disaster because she's terrible. Anyway, one of the other girls, Michelle, says to him, and it's, they get away with it, and this is how they land a lot of the moving stuff in the show, by delivering hilarious lines but with complete conviction. And so James is going to leave, and they're like, James, you can't leave. This is after they've just heaped endless shit on him for two seasons. Yeah. And he says, I think I have to go with Mum. And Michelle says to him, James, you can't go. You're a proper Derry girl now. And it's kind of the way she does it, it almost makes you cry at the same time that it's really funny, because it's the highest compliment they can give him, that he really is kind of one of them and that he's a Derry girl. And also you kind of realise, yeah, James is a Derry girl now. Like, he
really
has
is.
Kind of, yeah, it's, and just beautiful.
And it's that, it's like, what's that Anne Enright novel about, you know, the Irish family, that like the Green Road. Oh, God, sorry, Anne Enright. But just this sort of fierce squabbling and kind of multi-directional, like, trauma and kind of absolute clusterfuck. I mean, like, and yet this sort of fierce love is this sort of, it just makes me want to have a giant, like, confusing Irish family. I don't know. There's something so savagely loving about it.
There's a lovely bit where the peace deal happens, and they've had a day where they're really busy, and the TV's on the blink, and the family's going to the granddad, you know, the granddad or somebody's saying, nothing will have happened today, just don't worry about it. And they finally get the TV working at 8 o'clock, and the news comes on, and there's a peace deal. And it's just, it's been so funny, but then you have these real life moments of real events. And the grandfather, who's always ribbing his daughter's husband and calling him a useless idiot and so forth, he just, as they're watching the news, he just puts his hand on his son-in-law's shoulder. It's so well done. It's an absolutely beautiful show. Quick aside for another show that involves a girl group that I love and a new season's dropped, Girls Five Ever.
Ah, oh, right. So there is a new right, cool. So that's season three, right?
Season three of Girls Five Ever, yeah. And so I watched all that immediately because I love that show. And, of course, the kids, because it's been a couple of years, I think, since I watched the other two. When I watched the opening theme song,
The premise of this show is it's a girl band. It's like this. It's like the Spice Girls got back together, like in their 40s.
Yeah. But they are the opposite of MILF Manor in that they all kind of look like me and Annabelle Crapp. Like they're just middle-aged chicks who decide they want to get their girl
band.
Keep
recentering our unattractiveness as like reference points through this. Like, no, these girls are real wolfies.
It ain't called Looks Three for nothing. I forgot that I drove the kids mad by saying this line out of the theme song the whole time when I was watching it earlier. I went up to the kids and said, hey, kids, Girls Five Ever's back. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's good. And I said, you know what? It reminded me that I haven't said to you guys for a while. And they had forgotten as well. So they're like, what? And I'm like, what are you waiting five? Of course they both just went, oh, God.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you can get on a fairly annoying tear sometimes.
I can indeed.
Before we go beyond this kind of family saga kind of framework, I did want to mention that I've watched season three of a series called Breeders.
Yes, and now this is a thing that I've been meaning to watch ever since you first mentioned it because you've always raved about it. It sounds right up my alley.
Okay, like I think – so here it is. The premise – it's written – like conceived by Martin Freeman. So
Guy from The Office.
Guy from The Office.
And The Hobbit.
And The Hobbit and just – one of the most truly versatile and, like, he's the Jason Bateman of British television, I think. He's just an incredibly – you could put him time to a chair and not let him actually speak and he could act out a whole scene just using his face. Like,
right.
That is the
– Yeah, he's got quite a malleable face, doesn't he? Yeah,
right.
Now you say that.
Okay,
yeah.
So Breeders is set in London. And he is married to Daisy Haggard, who you've seen on like a bunch of things that we've talked about. She's also an actor possessed of an incredible face, right? And they have two kids who in series one are like little. And the thing that is so shocking about it, but also so centering and kind of wild about it, is that they are like, they love each other, they fight. And they really hate their kids some of the time. Like, and so, like, I mean, like, it's confronting because in one of the first scenes, Martin Freeman stomps upstairs. He's got a really fissile temper as well, which comes to be really interesting and sort of knotty in subsequent series. But, like, you'll walk in and the kids are, like, you know, run around doing kids stuff. You'll go, like, you little fuckers. Like, like it's really like, oh, okay.
Wow.
And they're they're little.
Wow.
Right? And so, but the amazing thing about, and so it's funny, you know, his parents are still around, her parents are split, like they're just sort of making do, you know, he works in a kind of job that he doesn't really love. She works in a job that is going somewhere, so they're constantly making kind of,
so
you know,
sacrifices. Is it a comedy or a drama?
Oh, it's a comedy, yeah.
Oh, right.
I mean, it's comedy, but it's got this sort of bitingness to it. And it knows how to just flip into pathos briefly and then flip out again. Like, I think you'll really like it. And so I watched the first two seasons, I think, and then I didn't watch the third, and now there's a fourth. So I've now absolutely gobbled up the third and I'm into the fourth. And the children are played by the same actors, and they, you see them growing up over the course of the series. Oh,
like that show we love, and with Pamela Adlon.
Yes, yeah. And I think
Better Things,
yeah. And so you get that same sense of emotional attachment to them and to the terrible things that happen because, you know, like any family, they have, like, people die, there's, you know, real dramas, people lose their jobs, kids get depressed and kids get anxious and, you know, and you actually kind of live through it with them, and it's still really profane and shocking. And Martin Freeman's tendency to kind of, like, blow up becomes, you know, an existential threat to the to the family. But somehow, I don't know, it's magical. I really, it's unbelievably good television, I think.
Oh, it sounds great.
Yeah. And it's also every now and then you get this bark of outrage when they just say something that's so dreadful.
I seriously need to watch that show. I've thought it ever since you first mentioned
it. Yeah.
While we're on family things, kind of very different but on the same topical terrain. So the kids and I over Easter for our movie night watched a thing we just stumbled across actually on Netflix called Grown Ups, which was an Adam Sandler film.
Oh.
Now, Adam Sandler, I can't say that I'm a great Adam Sandler fan. While I've seen some of the particularly, because he's had some huge hits, yep, obviously, and I have seen, unlike Ryan Reynolds, I have seen some Adam Sandler films.
Did he make that golf one?
Yeah, Happy Gilmore. Yeah. That's one of his biggest
ones. I quite
like that. You know, you just have your subjective liking of people and you find them funny. For example, for me, it's Hugh Grant. Like, I saw a clip of Hugh Grant on social media the other day presenting at the BAFTAs and he was doing his delivery.
He's pretty good in Wonka.
I've heard that. Yeah. I haven't seen Wonka yet. He's doing this. I mean, he just does such a beautiful shtick now in Cranky Old Man, and he's doing Oompa Loompa Dumpa Dee Doo.
Yeah.
There's an award now coming for you, or whatever. Anyway, how he delivers it is, I was just laughing from the second he opened his mouth. I just find everything about him super funny in a way that I don't find Adam Sandler particularly funny. But this film, our family actually loved it. And I mean, Adam Sandler, I'm obviously in a minority about Adam Sandler because he is, I think, the most bankable actor in the world, or if not the most bankable, one of the most bankable. His films just make money hand over fist.
So people, when you say, love Adam Sandler, I think he's the most bankable, do you mean that he is objectively the most bankable and you've researched this, or this is just the sales vibes?
My belief is that he is. Like, I have read things
But your belief is that you're also a member of the Australian Chamber Orchestra. So, like, I'm just checking. I'm just checking yourself before you wreck yourself,
I don't want to categorically declare that Adam Sandler is the most bankable actor in the world, because in my own mind,
so it's more of a few opinion, is what you're saying. Because, like, this sounds to me,
it'd fit on Fox News. I could say this on Fox News, no worries. But because it's Chat 10, I would like to have a bit of credibility. No, because there are other actors who are considered incredibly
bankable.
Speak
your truth. Speak it.
Matt Damon, for example, is also a very bankable actor. Like, these are people that they just, their films deliver a huge return. Okay, in a moment, I'm going to Google who is the world's most bankable actor. Siri, who is the world's most bankable actor?
If it responds with bonkable, I'm going to die laughing.
That can't be right. It says Samuel L. Jackson, number one. How can that be possible? I should have done this off air instead of wasting time now.
No, anyway. Everyone's enjoying it.
Look, I'll do a little video after this episode goes out and then we can figure it out. I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can make it. Oh, this is going back to 2010, of course. Okay, so that's why it's not. Yeah,
Siri,
I'll look it up. Siri, give us an up-to-date. No. So Adam Sandler is one of the world's most bankable actors. I can tell you that for a fact. I just don't know if he's the number one guy. But his films are insanely popular.
So Trumpy.
They
so
make lots of money.
What you've just done is so Trumpy. You've fact-checked yourself. You haven't found any support for your proposition. And you're now back into your flow.
Back into my
uninterrupted. Flight. Anyway, as I said,
Grown-ups. The premise of the film is these group of boys who played basketball together when they were schoolboys. They won this one championship and the coach had a really massive impact on their life. Fast forward to, you know, they're now all in their 50s and coach has died and they all come together. It's a bit of a Big Chill kind of thing. They all come together for the funeral and they bring their families with them and they're just kind of reconnecting with their youth and trying to reconnect, I guess, with their families and so forth. Mm. There's a lot of well-known people in it, like Selma Hayek, Adam Sandler's wife, Steve Buscemi has a funny cameo in it. Oh God, I've just completely blanked on the other five actors, the other four actors who are the dads, but they're all quite famous. And
not as bankable as Adam Sandler.
Definitely not as bankable as Adam Sandler, but the kind of guys who would be thrilled to find themselves in an Adam Sandler film if they could get some residuals from an Adam Sandler film. Mm-hmm. So it's...
Don't mind me.
It's funny. All of us were laughing aloud, and it's also kind of heartwarming. It was just a really enjoyable film, and I kind of walked away thinking... Yeah, I can see why people like Adam Sandler. He's got a real super everyman quality. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen him do some speeches at awards nights, and he just seems like a swell guy.
Oh, this is so annoying.
What? He is the top of the list?
This is so annoying. Yeah, he is. According to Forbes.
Fuck
you, Forbes.
What is he? Whatever
his films.
Who's
Forbes?
What are his films worth?
I don't know.
Billions. He's worth
74
billions.
Million is his... Oh, yeah.
Okay.
73 million before bonuses.
The lesson here.
Margot Robbie's number two. Woo! Go Aussie.
The lesson here I've picked up from actors is, actor mates, you want to get yourself into an Adam Sandler film.
Oh, and Rock, though.
And you want what's called, The Rock's, he's also
Wikipedia
very bankable.
Says
he's massively
the Rock.
Bankable. The Rock's huge, and so is Matt
Damon.
The Rock
is huge, he's huge, yeah.
The Rock's huge.
That's just a fact.
Where's Matt Damon on that list? He's always very bankable too.
So are we talking highest annual earnings or highest earnings for a single production? Because, like, if you're talking Leo DiCaprio, he's got to be in the wilderness sexual intercourse with bears for 3 years
that must be
before he makes a show.
That must be single production because Margot Robbie, she's had a few big hits in a row.
Mm. Keanu Reeves got $156 million for the first two Matrix sequels.
Wow. You want to get...
Who do you like?
Highest paid actress, uh-huh. Julia Roberts?
Nope.
Who's young and hip and happening at the moment? I don't know. Margot Robbie?
Nope.
Not Jodie Foster.
Sandra
Bullock, of course, yeah. Actually, I did Google her after the proposal and it did say that she is the world's most bankable actress too.
I just think one day we should just publish a book that's just your search history on your phone it would be very random.
What I was going to say was, you know how we did that episode of Play School and every year we get a residual? And I don't know what you get. Mine's
it's
about
like
$3.15.
You're getting 25 cents more than me.
But if you get on an Adam Sandler, so we're getting a cut basically every time they play that episode. What you
Mind
want
you,
is...
I am still the hit of the playground. I still see kids who are like...
Still gets mentioned to me too. What you want is to be in a film like an Adam Sandler or a Sandra Bullock film and to get a residual from that in your contract, because those films are so massive that even if you have a tiny role and even if it's a crap film, once a year for the rest of your life, you're going to get some money from Happy Gilmore or whatever it was that you agreed to be in.
Okay, I'll put that on my to-do list.
So you want to, when Adam Sandler rings to say, hey, I'm thinking of making this film, you go, yes, please, Adam, thanks so much.
He'll never call me now because
we can't pick up at the moment, Adam, we're recording,
all over
but
his
another time.
Bankability.
Now, and before we run out of time, another just quick couple of things. I watched Naiad, which I know you've already watched. That was wonderful. What a fantastic film. Annette Bening and Jodie Foster, just tremendous. I loved what it said about women's friendship. I loved that it had two amazing actresses who looked exactly like themselves with nothing having been done to their faces. They looked like their age, but they looked also like strong, amazing chicks.
Could swim to Cuba.
It was a wonderful, wonderful film. And I loved, there was a scene I loved where Jodie Foster, they'd had a romance years and years earlier, but it hadn't worked out. And then they were just best buddies. And there was a bit where they're kind of, Annette Bening's got her heart set on that she's going to swim from Florida to Cuba. It's an absolutely nightmare of a thing to attempt to do. And Jodie Foster's kind of acting in the role of her coach. And then everyone basically has had a gutful. It's too hard. They think Annette Bening's going to die. And then Jodie Foster says, I'm out. And then she comes back and says, look, as it turns out, when I survey my life, it turns out that you're like, you're my person. And, you know, they're not in love with each other. But she's like, that's how it's worked out. You're actually my person. And when you drop dead, I want to be the last face that you see, and so I'm coming for the ride. And then she does. And don't get any ideas that I want to see your face as the final.
Mate.
I just...
Even if I fix your binge?
Whose face would you want to see as the very final face that you see?
Probably
not mine. Not mine, Jeremy's, because we'd be going, quick, before you go, we need to get your passwords. So we can organise. You've left. We don't want to be left in disarray. Jeremy, have you got them? Hang on, quickly ask her.
just as if I know my passwords.
That's true, actually. Like, Jeremy's got them. Yeah, why am I wasting time asking?
On a piece of paper.
Jeremy'd be like, it's fine, Sales, I've got them. Naiad, sorry, I know I'm banging on. That also set me off to watch Silence of the Lambs, which I hadn't seen for years and years, to see young Jodie Foster. It's quite full on to go in one day from old Jodie Foster to young Jodie Foster. My God, Silence of the Lambs, it stands up extraordinarily well, chiefly because Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster are so incredible. The thing that's amazing is in the whole hour, 22 minutes, it's only in the final part do you ever see Anthony Hopkins doing anything gory. The whole rest of the time he's just in a cell. It's extraordinary how terrifying he's able to be when you never see him do anything and he's completely confined the whole time. The other thing that they do so well with that film, which I'd never noticed before when I saw it when I was young, was they're constantly filming Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster in extreme close-up where you're not even getting their full face, and they deliver their lines straight down the barrel of the camera. Yeah. They're not looking slightly off to each other. They both deliver, like, they're talking straight down the barrel, and it just adds to the terrifying nature of it because you feel like Hannibal Lecter is talking directly to you. It's really great.
Also, I would just say that, you know, As a viewer of movies, you've been in a position to watch Jodie Foster's face from the age of like 12, basically.
Yep.
All the way through to today. I don't know how old she is now.
She's
in her 60s.
Yep.
And it has always been the most bewitching face.
Oh,
for different reasons. I think at different points of her life. Yep. And she's been kind of wise enough to not ever do anything to it. And like the value of that is so evident, I reckon, in that movie Naiad. Same as Annette Bening, who's like one of just like an outrageously beautiful woman. Mm. And it's sort of, I don't know, it's an incredible thing to see and makes me feel a bit like, you know, watching a David Attenborough documentary, like, you know, as Hollywood denudes itself of people who aren't Ozempic skinny and who have got their own faces that they've had their whole lives.
Yeah.
There's a real snow leopard feel about the whole thing where you're like, oh, look, this is what old ladies used to look like.
You can only hope that women like that, that it does, it's so difficult, but you just hope it does encourage and embolden people, more people to just accept the inevitability that you are going to look, you've got two choices. You can look old and like yourself, or you can look a bit weird.
Yeah. Or sort of.
And I say that not judging, because I know it's hard for people to make these decisions, and it's hard looking in the mirror when you're getting old, but you are getting old.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. You are.
Yeah.
Your body is decaying.
But the thing is about that film, as I just gradually decay here, the thing about that film that is so, and I mean, obviously, we're just a couple of old bags, so we're like, oh, look at the old bags. I love old bags. Just like, should we watch Cocoon next? I think that the thing that is monumental about that film, Naiad, is just kind of the fun that they have together. And you can sort of see the lives that they've had in their faces. And, and that's kind of the central point of the film. So if you were doing it with two, you know, women in their 60s who looked like they were in their 40s, then there'd be no point to the film.
That's That's right. Yeah.
Anyway, and they're both just bad bitches, basically.
It was awesome. I'll talk a bit more about Annette Bening in the next podcast because I've started watching Apples Never Fall.
Oh, great. Okay, I've got one more thing to say that I've been watching just because this feels like a watchy one.
This is a watching one. We'll do a reading one next.
So, you know that Jon Stewart is back at the helm of The Daily Show?
I did not know this. As a temporary thing, or is that he's gone back there?
Yeah, he's come back. He's come back for the Trump, you know,
for
this year, right? Yeah.
Wow.
And
is he as good as ever?
Yeah, it's a real reminder of how that man kind of revolutionized political coverage through satire. And remember, there was that weird phase where he was suddenly the most trusted man in America, right?
It was incredible.
And if you think about the arc of American trust in institutions, in politics and whatever, I was sort of super interested because I didn't really follow a lot of the stuff that – because he did a podcast and another sort of show, he grew a beard for a while, I don't know. I kind of like was doing other things. But I just watched it on YouTube. You can – catch up with it straight away. I think he's doing like one show a week or something. Like, he's,
okay.
And it's just the timing, the ability that he has to, and it's a charm thing as well.
Oh yeah,
because of his the way that he uses the camera and the way that he is self-deprecatory as well. He can get away with really edgy topics, and he can kind of say. I mean, like, you know, he'll wade straight into the Middle East, for instance, which is probably territory that a lot of other TV hosts wouldn't necessarily go near. He's a master. It's really, really worth catching up on. And what I'm doing at the moment, because I think that The Weekly, which is our, you know, kind of equivalent, I guess, is just having an absolute boomer year this year. Like, so Charlie Pickering is kind of, you know, has been in that job for a long time. But there's some, like, this year feels, I don't know, it's really sharp, and they've got, you know, a bunch of good recruits in the show.
Yeah, Reese Nicholson is very funny.
Right,
yeah. I've loved Reese Nicholson's bits that I've seen.
So I'm kind of watching them side by side. Like,
right.
So the Weekly's on Wednesday night, so I'll sit down and I'll watch Jon Stewart. I mean, not to make Charlie feel anxious.
God, Charlie, just if you're hearing this, it's
but,
fine.
But, I mean, yeah, it's a really, it's a good double up, I recommend.
Oh, okay, that's an excellent recommendation. Mm. I'll take it on board. Thanks very much.
You're so welcome. Thank you for enjoying both the oral and the visual experience of me talking to this lady here. Subscribe to our YouTube channel for so much more content. It'll probably quell your enthusiasm, but give us a go or listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you ever think that we'd be telling people to subscribe to our content?
No, I did not.
We're cool at last.
Don't, you're making me look bad in front of my children again.